Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Sunday morning wake-up call, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I don't know how progressive this topic is, but it is quite important. Our guest today, Alexandra Metter, Augusta County's Assistant Commonwealth Attorney, graduate of JMU and UVA School of Law. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for being here. We're going to call you Alexandra for the hour?
I typically go by Alex.
So we'll call you Alex. Because Alexandra is asking me to fumble and stumble over that. So Alex Metter. So I have to ask you, Alex, how does an attorney gravitate towards this topic and this set of cases in her career?
So I think I actually gravitated towards this long before I decided to become an attorney. I worked on an Indian reservation in South Dakota for 4 years before I became a lawyer. And a lot of the children that I worked with had been sexually abused, and I felt a little bit helpless in the role that I had. I was a youth programs director and did a lot of direct contact work with these children. And in the end, I think that was one of the reasons why I decided to become an attorney, was because I saw the pain that these children were going through and the difficulties that they faced, and felt like I wanted a more active role in getting justice for these children, and decided to go to law school.
So you see this problem on an Indian reservation. Is that a high percentage of problem on an Indian reservation? I mean, and here we're mm-hmm. talking about sex abuse for people under the age of 18, I'm assuming.
Right. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the rate is a whole lot higher on an Indian reservation. It was just the population of children that I was working with. There are a lot of sort of complex factors that may lead to there being a somewhat higher rate on some Indian reservations. A lot of that has to do with historical trauma to Native peoples, and the fact that so many, several generations were actually removed from the home and sent to boarding schools where they were abused, sexually abused at the boarding schools, and the cycle of abuse had continued from there. So it may be a slightly higher rate than the rest of the population, but child sex abuse is unfortunately common in all areas, and not just on Indian reservations or places where you see a certain level of destitute poverty.
So why are you on an Indian reservation in the first place?
So when I was at JMU, I took a class called Contemporary Issues and Contemporary American Indian Issues, and I became interested in the subject and ended up deciding to do my honors thesis in Native American literature, and went and volunteered for the organization that I eventually went and worked for, Cheyenne River Youth Project, which is a nonprofit organization that works with children on the reservation and on Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota.
Again, our guest today, Alex Metter, Augusta County's Assistant Commonwealth Attorney. We are talking about a topic today that may have a few words or phrases that is bothersome Whether you're listening live, whether you're listening to the podcast, we will not be beeping out these words and phrases, so be cautious. The topic, child sex abuse. We'll be talking about trafficking a little bit throughout the hour. Again, child sex abuse and trafficking with Alex Metter from Augusta County's Commonwealth Attorney Office. So you're into this topic. It has your attention. You end up in Augusta County. But you don't go to Augusta County because that's where the action is taking place, right?
Right. I graduated, as you mentioned before, from University of Virginia School of Law, and decided, well, the last year of law school, I did a thing called the Prosecution Clinic, and that is a year-long class where it's more of a field placement, and I had my field placement in Waynesboro, which is a neighboring jurisdiction to the jurisdiction I work in now, and prosecuted there for a year under my third-year practice certificate, where you're supervised by another attorney, and you get into general district court and juvenile domestic relations court, where they prosecute the misdemeanors. And I handled a lot of those cases and found that I really enjoyed that work. I enjoyed being in court, and a lot of attorney jobs, there's very few actually, where that's a regular occurrence, and prosecution is one of them. And especially since I was interested in both child sex abuse as well as domestic violence, because I had had a lot of, not personal experience, but I had witnessed a lot of that amongst families I worked with on the reservation. So I cared a lot about that topic too, and that's another one of my specialties is domestic violence. I just decided to look for a prosecution job anywhere that would have me. And I clerked for Chief Justice Lemons of the Supreme Court of Virginia for a year after law school. But after that, I was searching for a prosecution job, and one opened up in Augusta County, and that's how I ended up there.
So when doing this type of work, so do you, in Augusta County, I'm sure there's lots of work to be done. I mean, unfortunately, there's always work for an attorney when talking about going to court. But are we talking about a few child sex abuse cases a year, a month, or... You know, is there a statistic you can give us, or how many of these are you working on? I mean, I have some statistics that I can give for that are sort of national. But if you only did this work in Augusta County, are you doing one a month? To a year?
Right.
And that's all you did was, oh, go get Alex off the bench. It's time for her to do one.
Now, it's actually quite more than that. So I would say that, so I've been specializing in this area for, I guess it's been almost 2 years now. And I've done over 100 forensic interviews, which we'll get into what forensic interviews are later, but the interview in which there's suspected child sex abuse and the child is brought in for a special interview for that. And I've participated in I would say at least 100 of those. And there's a significantly less that are actually brought to trial, but I've probably handled about 50 child sex abuse cases since I started focusing 2 years ago.
50?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Approximately.
And that's just in one county.
Yes, just in one county.
We're not talking about the state.
Right.
And that's a frightening number.
And
you're just talking about that's how far that case got. I mean, I heard you mention the word 100 as well. So there could have been 100 cases.
Not exactly. So one of the things that I love about the team that we have in Augusta County is that we have a group that helps us. They're called the Valley Children's Advocacy Center, and they are the ones that conduct the interviews for us. They are trained to do forensic interviewing.
So what is forensic interviewing? We've heard that phrase twice now.
Sure. So a forensic interview is an interview that is done by a trained professional who has training and specific education in this area, and there are certifications that you can get. I actually went and got the certification myself, although I don't do the interviewing myself because I'm the one prosecuting the case. But they're trained to ask questions in a developmentally appropriate way that is non-leading. So the idea of forensic interviewing is to let the child tell their story and to ask follow-up questions to clarify details and to fully understand the crime or whatever has been committed against them without leading them in any way into any sort of false disclosure, if that makes sense.
Goodness. It's child sex abuse and a little bit on trafficking again with our guest today. Alex Metter from Augusta County. She's the assistant Commonwealth attorney over there. It's a difficult topic. It is 11 minutes after the hour. Again, some difficult phrases and specific, what was the word you used? We're going to be talking about biological words.
Oh, anatomical body parts.
Anatomical body parts will be possibly used during the hour. There will be no beeping, whether you're listening live today or on the podcast later. This is the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call here on 94.7 WPVC. This is Rick Moore here. Some statistics that I pulled off of the web. Again, you can find statistics everywhere. Tell me whether these seem appropriate. 1 in 5 girls, a victim of child sex abuse sometime in their life. Children are most vulnerable between the ages of 7 to 13. During a 1-year study, 16% of youth between 14 to 17 had been sexually victimized. 3 out of 4 adolescents had been sexually victimized by someone they knew well. One in 20 boys were victim of child sex abuse. Approximately 1/3 of offenders are themselves juveniles.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at these statistics, they're difficult to, when you read them, these are difficult statistics to, you don't want to believe them, to understand that 1 in 5 girls. So if we brought 10 women into the studio here, and I realize, don't start giving me a hard time, listeners, that I can't, you know, use this format, but that 10 of the 10 in here that I may know, that 2 of them might have been victimized at a young age.
Yes, unfortunately, I believe that those statistics are correct. And furthermore, I think that probably at least one of those 2 will have never told anyone ever that that happened to them. So it's a very difficult crime to pinpoint in terms of statistics, just because, and this is another statistic I've heard, but I think that this plays out in my experience, that over half of children that are sexually abused never disclose to anyone, or the disclosure occurs much later after they're adults. So
what makes this program has done shows with the Sexual Assault Resource Agency, but typically those programs are about adults. What is different from child sex abuse and adult women or adult men? But when we talk about sex abuse, it's typically adult women is the imagery, the stereotype. What is different?
Are you talking about in terms of how the offense plays out, or
how the offense plays out, how the reporting gets done, mm-hmm. how the person who it takes place, whether or not, because you mentioned how the report never takes place. Mm-hmm. You said that if we bring those 1 in 5, how the 2 in 10, one of them will never report it in life. And that sort of thing. What's the difference between the child and the adult woman when the assault happens?
Well, the manner of the assault and how the assault is conducted, of course, is very different between a child and adult. I mean, there may be physical things happening that are very similar, but the approach of sexually abusing a child is typically something that's undertaken over time, that begins with a grooming process, of gaining that child's trust. And if you're not already a part of the child's family, which in a huge majority of cases, you are already a part of that child's family or close network. But if you're not, then it's about gaining the trust of that family. And starts just with paying special attention to the child and developing a special relationship with the child that eventually leads to inappropriate touching in a gradual manner that eventually leads to things like oral sex or digital penetration, then in some cases leads all the way to penetrative rape. But so it does look different from what you would see in the sexual assault of an adult female, which would be either unwanted physical groping or rape, is what you typically see with an adult. So, and then in terms of the disclosure, there's actually not a lot of differences. Most women do not report sexual assaults. And when I say, I guess I shouldn't just say women, I mean people who've been sexually assaulted, because men are sexually assaulted as well. And there's still a very high rate of delayed disclosure and a very high rate of non-disclosure, especially to authorities.
When, again, our guest today is Alex Metter. She's from Augusta County's Commonwealth Attorney Office. We are talking about sex abuse of children. Not a topic that everyone wants to hear about, but an important topic. Maybe some phrases and words that are uncomfortable for people, but we're not beeping them out, whether you're listening live or on the podcast. So be aware of that. We'll be right back. And back here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, this is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, on a beautiful but hot and sticky Sunday morning. Alex, one of the things that you hear people say all the time is, that guy's creepy. I bet he's a predator. So what are the keys? How can you spot a predator of children?
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the biggest misconceptions is that we think that we can. And certainly if there's someone who is hanging around a park and taking lots of pictures of children and look socially inept, that's someone to keep your eye on, and those people do exist. But the vast majority of people who commit these crimes are actually fairly charismatic. They blend in with everyone, and they are have a personality that enables them to gain the trust of various individuals. It's the people who don't have that are caught fairly quickly. The ones that are socially inept, the ones that have not done, this sounds sort of strange to describe it this way, a good job of grooming the family and the child to trust them. So you really can't spot a child predator just by looking at him. He doesn't have a specific profile. He could be an elder in your church. He could be a teacher. He could be the friendly next door neighbor. There really isn't a way to just look at someone and say that person sexually abuses children.
And I think if you read the news, the people who make the news and actually get the articles on them are the ones who stand out for being the ones you don't expect, right? Because I think somewhat recently, at least in 2017, once you and I started having contact about you being a guest on the show, there was someone in Greene County or Madison County who was a police officer or a sheriff,
mm-hmm,
because he had tens of thousands of pornographic pictures, child pornography, and was actually he was actually in a department to protect kids from, mm-hmm, from predators. I mean, those are the people who seem to make the news, are the ones that you wouldn't expect to be child predators. And so there are all types.
Right.
I mean, the ones who make the news are the church elders, et cetera. But are there things to do to make your kids less likely to be victimized?
Yes, there's absolutely a lot of things that you can do. Obviously, there's no foolproof 100% thing that you can do to prevent it, but there are lots of things you can do to give tools to your child to help talk to you about things. Basically, that's the main prevention tool. So the first thing is making sure that your child knows the correct anatomical words for all of their body parts. Words like words that.
Is this the part where we were telling people earlier? We're going to use some anatomical
people.
Parts.
Yes. And the words that adults even get embarrassed talking about, like the words penis and vagina and breast and you could say butt or bottom. It's really important for children to know these words, and it's really important for them to feel comfortable saying these words and for there not to be shame associated with these words, because it's the shame that the children feel in using words like penis and vagina that facilitate sexual abuse. The abusers use that shame as a tool in their grooming process to keep the child quiet. And so just teaching your child the correct anatomical words, and more specifically, teaching your child that there's absolutely no shame at all in speaking those words, especially when they're speaking with you. Never punishing a child for using those words. It can be embarrassing in public sometimes if you're little boy is saying the word penis but it's so important that a child does not feel shame in using those words, because that's the way that they're able to tell you what's happened if somebody has touched them inappropriately. Other things that are important are allowing your child to have bodily autonomy in how they show affection and with whom. So just to sort of give an example, I kind of see this, I have a wonderful church, but I see in church sometimes someone saying, oh, go hug her, go hug her. And then the little two-year-old feeling very reluctant and shy and going, oh, come on, please just go hug her. And I think it's an effort to, you know, form bonds with friends and and you don't want to hurt the feelings of the person that is potentially being rejected by the child. The child doesn't want to hug. But when we force our children to have physical contact of the intimate nature, like hugging, I mean, that's a sign of affection with someone that they don't want to or that they're not ready to. It teaches the child that their body is not their own, that adults own their body and what's done with it. And that can set up the child to be more vulnerable to sexual abuse later on. And so those things, and then I would say teaching a child boundaries with their body, and after you've taught them the anatomical names for their body parts, teaching them that there are certain body parts that other people aren't allowed to touch, and if they ever feel uncomfortable, then teaching them that they can come to you and talk about those things if somebody's done something that is physically uncomfortable for them.
I was reading about some of the cases that you worked on in Augusta County, and I don't remember the names of some of them, but just reading some of the news articles about them and how some of the people would tell the kids, now you can't tell your mother or your father that I touched you there, because then I would get in trouble and I would get hurt. If I, you know, if you told your mother that I touched your vagina, then I might get sent to jail and get beat up to make the young girl or the young boy, if he touched the boy, you know, beat up and injured in jail. And so there's also the guilt that plays a part of that.
Yes, and it can be a huge amount, especially if the abuser is a family member. So I think you're talking about, I know the case you're talking about in which that was said, and that was, I believe, a stepfather. So, or it may have been her actual biological father, who said that. And, if you can imagine, I think so many people don't understand why children don't automatically disclose something like this. And I think that comes from a fundamental just lack of understanding of the grooming process and how that works. Because by the time an abuser has touched a child inappropriately, they have developed a very close relationship with that child, in which lots of good things have happened too. And they're part of the grooming process, but there are things that the child loves, like being rewarded and being taken out for ice cream and being showered with love and affection and care and attention in ways that often some of these children are not getting from other people in their lives. And that's not saying that every child that is sexually abused is neglected, because that's not true at all. But the relationship that the offender builds with the child feels good to that child in the beginning. And it feels like they're getting love and attention that all children want. and then that gets, it changes at some point. And the child has all these mixed emotions about it because they had developed this loving relationship with this person, and this person starts to do things that they're a little bit uncomfortable with, but they can't even necessarily put words to yet. And so it really does take a very long time in most cases for children to feel comfortable disclosing. And part of that is what you mentioned. A lot of times abusers will put a lot of weight on the child in terms of the consequences of disclosing, that sometimes they'll tell the child that they are, they're the ones that are going to get in trouble. I've seen cases with stepchildren where it's been implied to them that they stole, that they would be seen as stealing the husband away, and that it would be a competition between the mother and the child, and that the mom would hate the child for it. There's also situations where, especially I think with biological fathers or grandfathers, where there is that sort of deep longing in that child for acceptance and love from that person. And so they don't want to hurt that person. They don't want that person to go to jail. That person shows them love and has shown them love. And they don't fully understand the impact of the abuse at that time.
Sunday morning wake-up call here with our guest today, Alex Metter. From Augusta County's Commonwealth Attorney Office. We're talking about a difficult topic, child sex abuse. A little bit of trafficking later in the hour. It is 31 minutes after the hour today. Some difficult words and phrases in the hour. Don't be surprised if we get into those a little bit. I've already touched on a few. If you're not in church and heard us, or you're listening to the podcast, Alex, you mentioned, you know, you've built that relationship, and so you've been rewarded, and you have, I mean, you have that bond, and so now, the relationship is ruined, if your stepfather or your grandfather, and again, this is such a stereotype of the male and the female, although I read that statistic earlier about 1 in 20 boys is a victim of mm-hmm. child sex abuse as well, is reported and caught and taken away. And the girl is responsible for that. And so there's the guilt again.
Mm-hmm.
She's the one who did that. And now there are no more good things that happen. It's like if you just accept this, then you still get these, you know, here's the one thing that happens and you get all these other good things that go with it.
Right. And I would add often, too, the abuser can often be the financial source of stability in the home. And so a child often has that on their shoulders as well, that if I tell mommy what happened, how are we going to keep our home? How are we going to eat? And they'll often put that on the child. And so and what I've seen more than anything is the child being afraid of hurting the non-offending parent, afraid of hurting them because they didn't tell them sooner, afraid of hurting them because what's happened to them is so awful. And often it takes children a while to actually process what's happening to them and realize that it's really bad. And once they do, they start to recognize the impact that telling is going to have on what we call the non-offending parent. Sorry, I use a lot of various lingo and things like that aren't necessarily used in the public, but that just means the parent that doesn't know that this is happening, and that and that they love. And by the time that cases get to us, often a child actually has tried to disclose a few times. But what that looks like is typically the child will aggressively minimize what's happened to them because of fear of the fallout. And so it could be as simple as, "Mommy, he hugs me funny." And the child thinks that she's disclosed what's happened to her. And she doesn't want to say more. And if a parent doesn't pick up on that, sometimes that can be a lost opportunity to discover what's happened. And so it's important to be attuned to that if a child's acting off, or if they're making comments about how someone's interacting with them and they seem uncomfortable. It's important to follow up on that and make sure your child knows that they can tell you anything without being in trouble for it. But that is the thing, is that I think a lot of people think that disclosure of child sex abuse, that sometimes children are making this up. And I'm not going to say that there are never cases in which there is a false disclosure, but when you look at the impact that this has on these families, especially when it's a family member or close friend, as most of my cases are, the impact is absolutely devastating. It rips the family apart, and the child often feels responsible for that. So you don't come forward and do that lightly.
So let's talk about prosecuting mm-hmm. a case, because that's what you do.
Right.
So now that we've talked about some statistics and how you get to this point. So do you get to this point because someone has picked up on the child telling? Do you get to this point because somebody noticed that guy's creepy and he must be a child predator, and a police officer or somebody mm-hmm. or an EMT picked up on it? Do you get to that point because somebody, you know, in social services followed up on it? How do you get there? How does it get to you?
Sure. So typically it's something that's recognized in the child rather than in the predator, because as I sort of mentioned before, it's very difficult to identify a predator. And so it's typically recognized in behaviors of the child. Sometimes it is the child disclosing to a trusted adult what's happened to them, or typically it's a minimized version of what's happened to them at that point. Sometimes it is a child. And by the way, everything that I'm describing is actually various signs of sexual abuse. So that can be sort of dually applied in thinking about what are the signs and what should I be looking for. Sometimes people will see children maybe interacting something with their Barbies or describing different actions or playing a certain game, and it sounds like inappropriate sexual knowledge for their age, and they might report it from that. Sometimes it's teachers, sometimes it's neighbors, friends, family members, non-offending parents that will make the first disclosure, the first report of the disclosure. A lot of times children will disclose to other children. That happens fairly frequently, typically not really small children, but kids that are in sort of upper elementary to middle school will feel a lot more comfortable talking to a peer about something like this that's happening to them. And then that friend goes and tells the school counselor or something, and then that's how we get the report.
40 minutes after the hour with our guest today, Alex Metter, Augusta County Assistant Commonwealth Attorney. We're going to come right back, and we're going to talk about the system and how it works. Sunday morning wake-up call, back in action. Alex Metter here. Child sex abuse, not the greatest Sunday morning topic, unless you just want to learn about things out there that nobody else is talking about.
Pretty heavy
stuff. But you know what? That's the thing. And that's how we started the hour, was how do you gravitate towards this? You gravitate towards it because it's needed.
Right.
Right? Because it's out there, and it oftentimes sort of like what's happening. It's under the rug, and it needs to have more attention paid towards it.
Yes.
It needs to have its discussion.
People, when I tell people what I do, I typically see sort of a stunned silence. And I think the first thing that people ask me is, how do you do that work? Or that work must be incredibly difficult. And it is. I guess you do develop a sort of way of dealing with it because you see it so frequently. You might call it a bit of desensitization, but it is hard work. But I'm the type of person that's motivated by a deep sense of passion in the work that I do. If it's not meaningful, it's hard for me to be motivated. And I view this work as deeply meaningful, and that's why I like doing it.
There was a story in the Stanton News Leader a year ago.
A year or two.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read a small part of it.
Okay.
They did, a 6-month study, and this part came from it. Victims tell adults who often don't know what to do. Responders don't have the resources to handle it, properly. And authorities mostly are not stopping the predators who target and damage our kids. You responded to me saying that you didn't agree with that very much. I mean, your reply to that was that you read that. It was, I don't know that you chose this word, somewhat disheartening because you didn't necessarily agree with it. Give me a reply to that.
I don't think that it's fully inaccurate. I guess I was referring more to the overall segment and some specific focus that they did on statistics that I thought were not necessarily the right focus. But I think that they're right in the sense that we are under-resourced, and often parents don't know what to do when a child discloses, or that's more from the emotions, I think, of the initial disclosure than anything. But I think that we've come such a long way in the prosecution of these crimes, and when we do have a long way to go. And it's the nature of the crimes themselves which create the biggest difficulty. And we have gone from, maybe a little over 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, handling these crimes kind of like every other crime, in which there's a disclosure to a police officer and whoever's on the beat takes the disclosure and maybe gets passed up to an investigator who doesn't necessarily have a lot of background training and knowledge in this area. And back 20, 30 years ago, a child would have to retell their story 10, 15 times to so many different people, the first responder, the investigator, the prosecutor, social services person, medical provider, therapist.
So what's wrong with that?
Well,
are we talking about, so let's talk about who, talking about the child.
Mm-hmm.
So give me an image in my head. Are we talking about a 6-year-old? Are we talking about a 12-year-old? Are we talking about a 17-year-old?
Can be any, actually.
Okay.
So, and the idea is that it's takes a lot of courage for the child to tell one time, and it can be, in many ways, especially with people who aren't trained, deeply traumatic for them to recount the events. And so it could just be extremely difficult for that child to have to recount the story of their abuse multiple times to multiple sources. But the problem with prosecution when a child is telling multiple sources throughout the investigation as well is that the brain affected by trauma doesn't record memory the same way that our typical memory functions work. It's scattered. It's a lot of times children aren't able to retrieve all of their memories at one point, but will be later on. And so they're telling various versions to each person. Some people are asking certain questions. Other people aren't asking other questions. So certain aspects of the abuse are coming out to some people and not to others. And then if you line up all of those various accounts, it's going to look like the child is inconsistent in what they're describing. So if they've disclosed one aspect of abuse to one person but not to another, a defense attorney can come in and they can say, well, they were lying about that. Look at how inconsistent this is. And so one of the reasons why I think prosecution of child sexual abuse has come so far is because of the model that was created to address that problem and to minimize the trauma on children when they disclose. And that's the model that was created by the child advocacy centers. And a child advocacy center is a place that is separate from all of the other stakeholders that are involved in these investigations. And their sole job is to seek the best interests of the child and interview the child in a way that is child-friendly, creates the least amount of trauma, and does not lead them in any way.
And that's accepted by the police, by the prosecutor. I mean, in all parts of the legal system have accepted what the advocacy center is doing?
In my jurisdiction, yes. So there are large swaths of Virginia that do not have access to a child advocacy center and are unfortunately having to do things the old-fashioned way that's not ideal for the child. We are very lucky in Augusta County to have an excellent child advocacy center. The Valley Children's Advocacy Center is the one that we use. And I know that Charlottesville area here has access through Foothills Child Advocacy Center. And so our areas are covered, but there are areas of Virginia that aren't. And it is accepted. I think that when a child advocacy center first comes on the scene in a jurisdiction, there is a little bit of friction as you're ironing things out because the officers have been used to doing it their own way and been used to doing it themselves for so long. But I don't think it really took that long in our jurisdiction for them to see the benefits of doing it this way. And how it typically works is, so we talked about sort of that initial disclosure, how it comes to us. It'll be either reported to law enforcement or social services, and a forensic interview will be set up. And then the child would come in for that forensic interview at the Child Advocacy Center, and our multiple disciplinary task force will all be there. So the task force is composed of the prosecutor, a social services person, victim witness advocate, and the law enforcement investigator, and there are other members of the task force that might not be there at that initial forensic interview, such as a pediatric sexual assault nurse, may also be involved at some stage, but not necessarily at that stage. And we all go, and there are cameras in the room, and the child, if they're old enough to understand the concept of the cameras and someone else watching, that will be described to them. Everything is, nothing's covert. It's all described that there are other people in another room watching that want to make sure you're safe, is what's described to them about the camera that's on the wall when the forensic interviewer is talking to them. And then we're all in the other room listening to the disclosure and writing down questions that we have. A lot of my questions will relate to elements of various crimes. If we need to have additional details from a child, for me to understand whether a certain crime should be chargeable in this instance, or the jurisdiction, if we've got the jurisdiction right, the time period in which the abuse occurred. And from there, I get to be involved in the investigation, which is something that's very different from how other crimes are prosecuted. A lot of times, prosecutors will become involved after the crime has been investigated by the police, and I get to be involved very early on so that it's a team collaborative process using all of our knowledge and training about children, about abuse, about these types of crimes to develop a investigative plan that attempts to corroborate the child's disclosure.
Goodness gracious.
I know it's a lot of complicated things.
Well, it's just, it is complicated, and it, I guess it needs to be, and it should be, because it's something that you don't want to do wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You want to do it right from the beginning, and you want to do it right for both sides, because you don't want it to be done wrong and have someone get away
right.
If they've committed the crime, but you also don't want someone to go to jail if they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. High stakes on both sides in these cases.
Our guest today, Alex Metter, she is the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney in Augusta County. We are talking about child sex abuse, an important topic today. 53 after the hour, just a few minutes left. Alex, I brought up the Stanton News Leader topic. One of the things that they also talked about, News Leader found that as many as 2/3 of the suspected child abuse cases, sexual, physical, or neglect in our area, never result in punishment for the abuser. Most aren't prosecuted at all.
Yeah, so this was sort of the thing about this article that I took the most issue with. I know the person who wrote this article, and they're great, and I thank them so much for shining a light on a very difficult topic that most people don't want to even think about. But I think that the thing that to keep in mind with these statistics is that one of the great things about the Child Advocacy Center we work with is that we will do a forensic interview if there's any suspicion at all or anything strange happening. We'll do a forensic interview, and a lot of them turn out not to actually be anything. So I'll give you an example, because this is included in the statistic of a child that's come in for a forensic interview, what he's saying about the 2/3. And we did not pursue this case.
Now, again, they come in for a forensic interview,
mm-hmm.
and they're there because?
They're there because somebody's concerned about them.
Okay.
It could have been a full disclosure that's already happened. It could be that this child has a rash. Which could be described by a lot of things. It could be that...
So there was suspicion.
Suspicion.
There was suspicion that something bad is going on.
Right. And so, and I'll give you an example of a case that where I declined to bring charges. There was a suspicion because a child had disclosed to I believe it was either a daycare worker or a teacher, that her babysitter was touching her, I believe she referred to it as her monkey, again, the importance of importance of teaching the anatomical body parts. So monkey was referring to vagina, touching her monkey and hurting it. Well, that is a very alarming disclosure. So we had a forensic interview, and we also interviewed the mother. And what it turned out to be was a 15-year-old female babysitter who was applying approved medication to the child's vagina because the child had a yeast infection. And I decided not to bring charges against that 15-year-old babysitter, of course. And so, I mean, this is included in those statistics. And so we bring it. Any suspicion, we bring a child in for a forensic interview, and that's because the Child Advocacy Center is a friendly place to be. It's non-traumatic to be interviewed in that environment, and it's the best place where we can get everyone together to see, is this child safe? What is going on with them, and what do we need to do? And thankfully, in several cases, the suspicions are unfounded, and the child's fine and not being abused. And there are certainly a number of other cases that are included in that statistic in which we do believe something may be happening, but the child is not comfortable enough to disclose. So we send them to therapy and hope that they'll disclose later. There are other situations in which the circumstances of the case make it very difficult to prosecute. But I just wanted to make sure that included in that is understood that there are actually a lot of situations in which children are brought to the center and are interviewed, and we find that they're actually okay.
But there are, and not in Augusta County, I'm not picking on Augusta County, but I think nationally the stereotype is that public attorneys prefer to get a plea rather than go to trial because it's easier and less expensive. And judges, and the stereotype is that sexual abuse doesn't always get the hardest, decision that it could.
Mm-hmm.
And from juries or judges, mm-hmm. Do you think that that's true?
Well, one thing I could tell you is that I don't, when it comes to the safety of a child, I don't care anything about easy or cost. And there is a very big misconception about what plea deals actually do in the public. A lot of people think if someone makes a plea deal, it's to either go easy on the offender or to, like you said, prevent the expensive trial. But really what it is in these cases, because these cases are so difficult to prove, and I haven't really gotten into all the reasons why, it's a cost-benefit analysis every single time. How much time can I get out of this offender? And what are the risks of going to trial? What's the likelihood with this particular child that a trial in which they are demolished on the stand by a defense attorney is going to re-traumatize them in ways that they cannot recover from? And you weigh all of those factors, every single case, case-by-case basis, and you come up with an offer that holds the offender accountable, that makes the public safer, and gets justice for that child while trying to minimize the trauma to that child of going through a trial. And those are my goals and pleas, and it's certainly not because I don't want to work hard at a trial, which I am more than happy to do, or because we think that it's expensive. There's no expense that we wouldn't spare to keep children safer.
Alex, thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Next week, John Whitehead, Rutherford Institute. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.